Greg LaBelle may have retired from teaching political management at George Washington University a few months ago, but that doesn't mean we're going to leave him alone. Not when so much of what's happening in Washington cries out for the kind of big picture expertise that Greg has spent a lifetime amassing. And so I'm delighted to have Greg LaBelle back with us once again. Greg, thanks for being here.
It's nice to talk with you, Welton.
Are the kinds of policies, tweets, leaks, and confusion emanating from this White House signs of genuine chaos, or potentially, is this a part of a plan?
You know, that definitely is the key question. And I think, aside from the policies, I think the chaos is really the fascinating part of this. I do think that if you look back at Donald Trump's history as a business person, chaos is his milieu. As a business person, I think that's sort of where he lived. The idea, sue, counter-sue, settle, I don't care what you say about me, just spell my name right, to the media. I think that has been his modus operandi for many, many years. And I think what we're seeing is that this is where he's comfortable and that it does not work in the context, certainly, of government. And then you overlay on this confusion and mixed messages on so many issues, it just adds to that level of chaos. I suspect that this is generally how he wants to play the game. But I think the people around him have got to be frightened to death every morning when they wake up and look at their cell phones and see what might have happened in the last few hours when they were sleeping. So it doesn't seem to me to bode well, regardless of what one thinks of his issues. I don't see how anyone could look at this and say, yeah, this is a good way to run the country.
Well, I want to look at both theories for a moment. Those who support the plan theory will say Steve Bannon is known for this kind of strategy. The more chaos, the better, as he seems to see it. What are your thoughts on that one?
I think that's a perfect fit. I think you're right. Bannon has been a bomb thrower from the sidelines for a very long time. And I think that's probably why the stories we're seeing are that Bannon and Trump are working very well together. There are increasing numbers of stories that say that Reince Priebus is in serious trouble of being shut out from the decision-making process in the White House. So you've got that Trump-Bannon kind of similar mindset that's playing itself out. And then you watch people try to justify and defend and explain what's coming out of the West Wing, and you just watch them sort of twisting in the wind and trying to figure out how to put this into some sort of language that makes some sense as they're trying to justify it to the American people.
Well, let me go to the chaos argument then. That includes speculation that the administration underestimated how big a job the presidency is, or dismissed the value of expertise, or that the president is simply unable to focus enough to lead effectively. Would you talk about that point of view?
I will, because I don't think that the two theories stand apart from each other. I think both theories are true. We have a president and a guy who has risen in importance in the White House, and Steve Bannon, who do function in this chaotic manner. This is what they know and they're comfortable with. I think for everybody else, for most people who are left sort of in this circle around, that chaos is not their modus operandi. It's not what they're used to. So you have this comfort level at the very center of the West Wing that does see this chaotic approach as how they've done business in before and why can't we do it now? And all of these other people around them are just sort of struggling to sort of fit this mode of operating into a government model. And we've seen it doesn't fit.
Greg, how would you diagnose the relationship between the current president and the Republican-led legislature?
Now, that's becoming increasingly clear as well, I think, as we've seen their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare in particular, but what we've played itself out around the immigration ban, the continuing discussion of building the wall on the southern border. And here's the theory that's developing in my head. The Republican leadership and increasingly Republican rank and file over on the Hill are having more and more difficulty justifying, explaining, getting behind where this administration seems to be going, which, as we've just discussed, sometimes changes by the hour. And they're uncomfortable with that. This doesn't work well. So you see a lot of, again, the sort of dancing around the issues, trying not to answer them. But my theory is that with the Republican leadership may be looking at it this way. And I think there are a couple of exceptions, John McCain being one of them, who seems to have reverted to the John McCain that I think we all had some respect for before he had to get reelected to the Senate last year, and is sort of now moving back to a more reasonable kind of a approach on these issues. And he may be, in many ways, the lone voice out there. But I think the Republican rank-and-file members and the leadership are looking at that as, we've got two branches of government covered. We've got the House, the Senate, and we've got the executive branch. Let's get what we can out of this. Do something with health care. Do something with immigration. Do those kinds of things that we've been promising the American people we would do. If we can squeeze those out, that's great. If in the process Trump becomes, and I think this is entirely possible over the next couple of years, if Trump becomes an albatross around their collective necks, I think they'll hang him out to dry, especially if these folks see their numbers beginning to drop as they're approaching, particularly on the House side, and that one-third of the Senate that will be up for re-election in 2018. So I think the attitude is, let's see what we can get so that we can go back and say we accomplished these things, and if this guy becomes a real serious drain on our popularity, we cut him loose.
Greg, you won't be surprised. I'm deeply concerned about the ongoing demands of the political religious right on this administration, which they clearly think they own. We've seen really ugly initiatives against immigrants, against LGBT people and other groups already. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how far all of this might go, and if there isn't some kind of self-correcting mechanism that we ought to be expecting to eventually come into play.
Really, really interesting question. And I think there are sort of two power centers in the administration now that are on opposite sides of some of these issues. I think especially the issues around LGBT issues, I think you have Mike Pence, who is a poster child and has been a poster child for the religious right when he was as governor of Indiana, and it's a congressman before that. Absolutely no question about that, and I think he wields some power, although it's very difficult to assess just how much power Mike Pence does wield over in the West Wing right now. I don't think we've quite figured that out. On the other side, you have Trump's daughter and son-in-law, who seem to be more moderating influences on him around these particular issues. So you have sort of a battle for getting his attention between Ivanka and her husband and Mike Pence on some of those issues. On reproductive health issues, it doesn't look particularly good. Planned Parenthood is taking it on the chin in the president's budget. And I think the effort is to try to keep that part of their base together. So they've got to find some things to do for them. Again, it's hard to tell whether any of this has anything to do with core principles on the part of the president, because we've really never seen any real evidence of what those core principles might be. So I think it all boils down to how he perceives his place in the terms of hardcore politics and what he needs to do to keep people on his side. And I think that's what he will do. So there's no sort of principled approach to this that we can sort of count on. It's going to be a matter of hardcore political mathematics in terms of what they will do or not do.
Have there been any encouraging signs that you've seen since the inauguration that give you some hope about this administration?
I thought about it. No. I really wish I could say yes. But I can't. You know, we watched that, you know, the speech to the joint session of Congress, and I read a newspaper reporters and columnists saying, oh, this was he was finally presidential, and you know, this was a presidential speech. And I watched that speech, and I saw the same old stuff. I just saw a guy who used his indoor voice instead of his outdoor voice to deliver it. But in terms of content, in terms of his own sort of ego in talking about these issues, and in particularly in talking about about the widow of the soldier who was who lost his life recently. He even turned that into an ego-driven sort of comment. So, no, I desperately want to say yes, but I can't. And again, a big part of that is because I don't think anyone, and I think this goes for a lot of the White House staff and members of Congress, have figured out where the hell this is going.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the way the press has covered the new presidency so far, and how do you think they've done in the face of the kind of hostility that many have been subjected to?
Yeah, I would say that they are trying to make up for the many mistakes that they made during the campaign in giving him the attention. And again, this circles back to the first thing that we were talking about. This is a guy who has always known how to get press attention, who knows that the more outrageous things he says, the more attention he will get. The press has sort of finally figured that out, I think. And I have sensed on the part of the mainstream media, both print and broadcast by and large, an effort to try to give more perspective than has been done or until this candidacy and now presidency has been necessary to give more of a detailed, nuanced sort of coverage of what he's saying. I mean, one thing we see is sort of standard now. When Trump says something that's clearly wrong, the media will say that. Trump accused so-and-so of such-and-such, and, you know, there's no evidence of that. I mean, this is a thing with President Obama tapping his phones. It's a classic and outrageous example. But the media is no longer taking the stuff at face value. I also sense that, and this is quite a step for, I think, the competitive news media, particularly the broadcast news media. I think we've seen members of the media beginning to step up and defend each other, defend each other's right to be in the room and to cover stories the way they need to be covered. And this is relatively recent. It didn't start with the new administration. I think when the president started banning people from the press room, being very selective as to who could be participating in coverage and briefings, I think that the media in general sees this an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. And I think we're beginning to see a significant and important shift, because the media has got to shift on this and become, it will become one of the most important means by which we figure all this out and figure out what to do. We know from past history, we knew that in the civil rights movement, it was coverage in the media that brought Americans around to understanding what African Americans were facing in this country. It's true about Watergate. I think that has got to happen. And I think they're moving in that direction.
Greg, if you were still most every day spending most of your time in a classroom with students, what would you be telling your students to pay the most attention to, and why?
I'm going to answer the question a little bit differently, because I think what we need to do is give them some perspective mm-hmm. on what we're seeing. Because students are young. For many of this is probably the first time they've really focused on national political issues, national policy issues. And I think what's important is they have some perspective. They need to understand how different this is and how it does or does not fit into democratic theory, how this country has run, how it was set up, how it was intended to run, and how it manages to function. Because what we're seeing almost daily are attacks on the very core of our democracy, our democratic process. I will tell you that I think we have done, as a nation, done a pretty bad job of educating our young people to understand what the democratic process is. So now we're looking at this, and, you know, quite frankly, I think the thing that they have most, that comes closest to that they can compare this to, is reality TV, which I guess isn't surprising considering who we're dealing with here. But it's that need for perspective in what makes government work, so that they can sort of apply what they're seeing to that model and make some assessments.
Greg LaBelle is the newly retired assistant professor of political management at George Washington University. Greg also spent many years working inside several presidential campaigns. It's always valuable, Greg, to hear from you on what's happening in our politics and in our government. Thanks so much for taking the time once again to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.